From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. This week has been all about North Korea here. On May 6th, Pyongyang convened its first Workers' Party Congress in 36 years, a spectacle of pomp and circumstance that lasted 3 days, but didn't seem to result in much change for the reclusive regime. Here to talk with us about the Congress is Bruce Klingner. Klingner is a senior research fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. He is an expert on Korean and Japanese affairs, having spent 20 years at the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency. I'm definitely looking forward to hearing his thoughts about the events in Pyongyang this week. So, Bruce, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So this Congress was a highly anticipated event. In the lead up to the start of the Congress, analysts were predicting everything from massive economic reforms to a fifth nuclear test. And I'm very curious to get your point of view, but from my reading, it seems like none of those things really happened and not too much came out of it. So do you think this Congress ended up being the big event that we thought it was going to be?
I think it fulfilled the purposes that North Korea wanted, which were a lot lower than what many people predicted it would be. The fact that it was so rare, even historic, as you pointed out, the first time in 36 years, it led people to expect something grandiose. Why would Kim Jong-un have a party congress without some very large purpose, whether it was massive purges or personnel reshuffle, identifying and articulating economic reform, which many people have been predicting for decades, or further bragging of a nuclear test. We had expected a fifth nuclear test, the second this year, sort of coinciding with this, none of which happened. So in that sense, it was underwhelming. After the fact, North Korea pointed out that its objectives were affirming the party's rule, affirming some policy adjustments and personnel adjustments, nothing as large as we had been predicting. So it was really pageantry over policy change. It was rubber stamping over reform.
So one of the announcements that did emerge was that North Korea would strengthen its self-defensive nuclear capabilities, but they pledged they would not use a nuclear weapon unless its sovereignty was infringed first. So how meaningful is this statement in reality, and what does it actually mean in terms of how we deal with the North from here on out?
It really is very much a reiteration of what they've been saying. Some will latch on to the no first use pledge, which they've said in so many ways over the last couple of years. But really, the message there is rebuffing the requirement to abandon its nuclear weapons as required under numerous UN Security Council resolutions. It really is no denuclearization, along with no economic reform, no personnel change, and really no transparency, as we saw with the 130 foreign journalists being taken for a ride, literally and figuratively, without being able to report on the events themselves. And then, the crowning glory of that was the BBC reporter being expelled for, being disrespectful, and even the LA Times reporter not being invited to a press conference because her articles were not beautiful, meaning they weren't sufficiently adulatory about Kim Jong-un.
To follow up on that, because that is something that I found really, I guess, in one way interesting, but in one way not that surprising, I guess. Why invite 130 foreign journalists and then not let them near the event? I mean, why invite them at all at that point?
That's very puzzling. They had invited journalists for some of the previous missile launches, and when one of them failed in April of 2012, then they were actually very transparent in admitting that it had failed, perhaps, if nothing else, because the journalists were right there. So because they invited so many of them, people really were expecting that it would be some big event, big announcement, and that it reflected that Kim was very different from his father, and more like his grandfather, much more gregarious, much more open to interacting with people. So they thought because he was a Swiss-educated student that he's much more open in meeting with the North Korean people and giving speeches, which his father did not. So there was an expectation that whether he interacted with the journalists, that his government would be different, that at least in form, that he would be more open to showing behind the scenes or showing what the Congress was up to. So again, it was a lot of buildup of hope and expectation for a major announcement or major changes, and very underwhelming on so many fronts.
To get back to the nuclear issue briefly, the American position for quite some time has been that we are willing to talk to North Korea with the caveat that they denuclearize, and that we can't accept nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula point blank. So given that North Korea has essentially solidified the things that it has already claimed about being a nuclear state, is there any room for positive movement in the near future?
Not really. Some will criticize the U.S. for having preconditions, but really the U.S. position along with its allies is we really just want you to do what you pledged many times before. You signed 4 international agreements never to pursue nuclear weapons, and then 4 international agreements to give up the weapons you promised never to have in the first place. So we really just want you to do what you already promised to do, and also do what is required under several UN Security Council resolutions. So in that way, it's not very hard line. And as long as North Korea says we will never, ever, ever, ever give up our nuclear weapons, which is the sole or the primary purpose of the 6-party talks, it's kind of hard to advocate going back to the talks as long as your principal negotiating opponent vows never to abide by the basic premise. So the U.S. has tried to reach out. President Obama tried in 2009, and then again in 2012 with the Leap Day Agreement. So, for those who are advocating engagement or negotiations, really anything they're suggesting, the U.S. tried in 2012, and once again, North Korea broke that agreement.
One other announcement that came out of this Congress was that Kim Jong-un was officially named the chairman of the Workers' Party of Korea. Given that he was already the head of the party, but the title was just slightly different, it was the first secretary, what significance does this announcement have for him going forward?
Well, I think it's his 7th major title. He got 6 titles within the first 6 months after his father's death, a marshal of the Korea People's Army, a list of other ones, which basically within 6 months had given him absolute control over the military, the party, and the government. This is just a further adulation of his wonderfulness. The fact that you still have Kim Il-sung as the eternal president, though he's been dead these many years, Kim Jong-il is still the eternal general secretary of the Korea Workers' Party. So it really is the world's first necrocracy, a country ruled by dead guys. So now Kim Jong-un is the chairman instead of the first secretary. It's not necessarily a promotion. He already had all the powers. And that raises another issue. People had thought this might be a consolidation of his power, and I think it was more a coronation than a consolidation. We still have disagreements. Some feel that there's still factionalism and hardliners and softliners battling for control or influence over Kim Jong-un, just as they postulated that under Kim Jong-il. I think Kim Jong-un had the power very early on. If someone was going to move against him, they would have done it right after his father's death when he didn't have the titles yet. But even then, we've had no evidence of purges or coup attempts. And we also debate about the purges. And some would say that it's a weak, embattled leader desperately trying to fight off real or imagined enemies. I think it's more a strong, confident leader who's feel he can go against even the senior-most leadership. His uncle, the second most powerful man in North Korea, certainly faced a dire demise. And then he's replaced his minister of defense 5 or 6 times, his chief of the general staff 5 or 6 times. So he really has no hesitancy in exercising his power and going against his opponents if he feels that he has them, which I think people are more likely just keeping their heads down.
So one anticipated move that did not come to fruition, besides the 5th nuclear test that did not happen, was involving Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong. Analysts expected that she would play a greater role in the Congress and that she would perhaps be appointed to a higher position in the regime, but this does not seem to have been the case. Are you surprised at the way things turned out for her this week, and do you think this is a sign that she's kind of out of favor at this point?
We probably have to be careful about reading too much into things. Just because they don't do what we predicted doesn't mean there's a reason behind it. I had thought, and you know, agreed with some people who thought that she seemed to be a growing power or a growing presence on the scene. But either Kim Jong-un or maybe she prefers exercising power behind the scenes, or maybe they just figure they have a very long reign ahead of them, so they can bring her along on a slower basis. But, you know, that was one we had predicted. I think the other non-change on the personnel side was, you know, we still have a lot of the old guard there. I think we had expected to see a more wholesale replacement, not even necessarily a purge, but just, you know, clearing out the dead wood, people who are 70 or 80 years old that they would replace, but it seemed like a number of them were kept in place. So, you know, what we may see is more frequent party congress or Supreme People's Assembly under Kim Jong-un, because that's more like what his grandfather did than his father. So perhaps the fact that the Congress was so boring reflects that it's going to be more routine, that Kim Jong-un is going to exercise power more like his grandfather, going through government entities, through government processes, still retain absolute control, but do it in a more methodical or official appearing manner than his father. Kim Jong-il would sort of be very reclusive. He'd use the fax machine to send directions, often contradictory, to 30 or so inner members of the circle. And he would have overlapping areas of responsibility to keep them not only on their toes, but in fear, and always trying to constantly maintain, you know, good relations given the consequences which could occur if they were on the out. So it may just be that this is going to be a more routine kind of government exercise of power while, of course, Kim controlling it all.
Speaking of reading into things, this might sound a little frivolous, but bear with me. Many outlets, including BuzzFeed, which I thought was interesting, and others that don't usually follow North Korean politics on a day-to-day basis, covered the Congress, but they were focused on Kim Jong-un's fashion choice, his interesting silken striped suit with a tie and glasses, which I think definitely not what he normally wears. So fashion choices aside, it seems interesting that for such an important and widely followed event, he chose to wear a Western-style suit as opposed to the more, I guess, uniform-like black suit. Do you see any significance there, or is this reading into things?
Well, we, you know, all of us tend to delve into some of the more frivolous aspects of North Korea, and we've all made gallows humor jokes about North Korea. And we focused on his clothing as well as his wife's. I remember doing TV interviews where I was a bit surprised when most of the focus was on his wife and her choice of clothing and the fact that she had reappeared after a few months' absence. You know, in the pinstripe suit, he looked a bit like Al Capone, you know, rather than his sort of Mao-style attire, which his grandfather had favored. You know, also, you know, a lot of focus on his hair. I mean, he sort of has this rhomboid-shaped hairstyle, you know, more reminiscent of some of the folks from the Jersey Shore TV show. So we focused on that. We joked about that. But, you know, whether it's a Western attire to reach out to the Western nations, I think that's going too far. His message certainly was deal with me on my own terms or don't bother.
I want to go back to something you mentioned briefly earlier on, which is the economic side of things. There were some economic reforms that were announced, but more or less they reiterated the Byungjin line of nuclear weapons along with economic growth. Where does this leave North Korea going forward? Are these reforms going to make any difference? Are they in a place where they can have any sort of sustainable economic growth?
Well, some folks have focused on Byungjin as, you know, a major shift, and that since it's mentioning economics along with nuclear weapons, that this is a major shift and that it's a more benign policy. Also that Kim Jong-un is tending to exercise power through the party rather than the military. And also there had been some predictions that he would, whether officially or unofficially, abandon the military first policy of his father and put Byungjin over it. I mean, first of all, as Kim Jong-un pointed out in a March 2013 speech, Byung-jun is a descendant of the policy of his grandfather. He said in December 1962 that they had adopted this dual policy of strong military along with economic objectives. You know, I think Kim Jong-un has just grafted on a nuclear face onto a policy that's been there since 1962. And if you read the last decades of New Year's Day speeches and others, you see a common thread of focusing on industry, and they may pick a different industry each year to focus on, or different aspects of farming. So really, the dual characteristics or the dual track is very consistent with what North Korea has been doing for decades. And the fact that he really just grafted it on top of military first, he said North Korea is continuing that policy, again, shows the strong emphasis on nuclear weapons, and that they will not abandon them, they will increase them both qualitatively and quantitatively. So I don't really see a major shift. And again, if you read the text of the speech, just like the New Year's Day speeches, it's just replete with references to socialism and official plans and, you know, following the guidance and the quotas and the plans directed by the central government. There's no comments about marketization or really liberal reforms on the economic side. No signals of we're going to try something new, or that because we have a strong nuclear deterrent, we can now shift to new areas to improve the livelihoods of our people. We didn't get any of that. So really, I think it's going to be a lot more, you know, more of the same. You know, there are economic changes, and we can debate, as we've been debating for decades, whether North Korea is implementing economic reform. The fact that we're still debating it, I think, shows that it's very minimal. It's more, in some cases, accepting changes that the people themselves are bringing about. Sometimes a grudging acceptance of reforms or changes, which then they will cut back on once either the economic conditions improve or they fear that they're losing control over the minions.
Great. So we've covered a lot of ground as far as the Congress this past week. Is there anything else that you think was important that we haven't discussed?
Well, outside of the Congress, you know, we'll still debate North Korea's capabilities. We don't think they have a hydrogen bomb like Kim Jong-un declared both now and in the last couple months. It may have a boosted fission, which is sort of an atomic weapon on steroids. And, you know, he may not have an ICBM capability today, although three U.S. four-star commanders believe North Korea has that ability already. So we'll continue to debate, you know, whether they've miniaturized or not. But really, I think the bottom line there is whether they have a capability today or tomorrow or next year, we know what path they're on. We know they're not going to give up the weapons without a great deal of pressure. And there's not a lot of optimism that diplomacy, even with targeted financial measures and sanctions, will get North Korea to give up the weapons. You know, that said, sanctions do a number of interim objectives: enforcing our laws, imposing a penalty on those that violate our laws, and putting in place measures to impede both the inflow and outflow of prohibited nuclear and missile technology. But we, I think, are in for a long haul here, as we've already faced decades of the North Korean challenge. It's going to get more dire. It's going to get more precarious. And the more that North Korea brags about its nuclear capabilities, during a crisis, that may lead the U.S. or South Korea to lean further forward on preemption. So I think, as always, the Korean Peninsula, we're going to have the concern about miscalculation and escalation.
Not an optimistic note to end on, but that's how it is on the Korean Peninsula these days.
I think it's pretty hard to be optimistic when you're dealing with North Korea. It's just a matter of, you know, managing risk, managing the dangers that are there. And as people who have served on the DMZ have said, is that even a tactical situation can become strategic in the blink of an eye.
Right. So thank you so much for joining us today. It was a really great discussion. As I mentioned, we've covered a lot of ground, so I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, well, thanks again for having me.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. As always, thank you so much for joining us for this great conversation. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. And do remember that you can go back and listen to our archive of episodes at keia.podbean.com. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll be back again next week with another great episode.